You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Bike Radar podcast, brought to you by the team behind BikeRadar.com, Cycling Plus, and MBUK magazines. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe. And if you can do so, leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps us reach other cyclists like you.
Welcome to the Bike Radar podcast. My name is George Scott, the editor-in-chief of Bike Radar, and today I am joined by deputy editor Jack Luke and Ashley Quinlan, one of our senior road technical editors on Bike Radar. Good morning, chaps.
Good morning, George.
Good morning.
Well, today we are going to bring you one of our buyer's guides because we have been thrown into the depths of autumn with winter fast approaching here in the Northern Hemisphere. So we're going to talk about road lights. If you are a regular listener to the podcast, you will have noticed that we had a buyer's guide to mountain bike lights in recent weeks, and we'll put the link to that podcast in the description, so do check it out if you're an off-road rider. But here we're going to focus on road lights. But before we get going, Jack, I know you're a keen winter rider. However, the weather has been pretty grotty recently. So have you been venturing out, or have you finally consigned yourself to getting on the turbo trainer?
You will never catch me riding indoors. I am very much a dedicated winter rider. I do enjoy night riding as well, and I have committed to a few spook zone rides, as I like to call them, already this season, and enjoyed every single one of them.
How about you, Ash? Where's your riding taken you recently?
I have done a tiny bit of Zwifting, more just to check that my power output is where I want it to be at this time of year. But I like to go outside as well, to be honest. Get a lot of testing done. It's just the best place to do it, really. I like the fresh air.
I know last time we spoke on the podcast, you were nursing yourself back to full fitness after a knee injury. So what's the update there?
It's coming along nicely, actually. I've been to seeing a sports therapist to help me out with that, to cure any sort of underlying issues, which is going really well. Got an S&C program in place. And had a bike fit along the way as well, which we're hoping to create some content around on soon. So that's gone really well as well.
Brilliant. Well, both of you have referenced your desire to keep riding outside through winter. And if you are going to keep doing that, if you are going to log those winter miles through these cold, dark months, then owning a decent set of bike lights is really important, whether you're scooting through the city to and from work or heading out into the depths of the lanes where they're kind of unlit and you need a light to illuminate the road ahead of you. So in this podcast, we're going to run through what you need to look for in a road light and hopefully along the way, smatter in some of our product recommendations, which you can also find on Bike Radar on our buyer's guide to the best road bike lights. So Jack, to kick us off, one of the key differences when looking at a set of road lights, in particular a front light, is the idea of choosing a light either to be seen with or to see with? And that's something you often see referenced by brands. So can you describe what the key difference is there?
Absolutely. So lights to be seen with are really designed primarily to improve your visibility on the road at night. And that's generally reflected in lower overall power outputs and generally a smaller form factor. They are designed for commuting, and the idea being that you're going to be riding primarily in lit areas. So cheaper, less power, and generally smaller. Lights, on the other hand, to see will have a much, much higher power, and we tend to suggest around 400 lumens as being the minimum for that, though it depends on the design of the light as a whole. And the idea is that on unlit roads or perhaps on poorly lit streets, these will show you the way ahead, highlighting any imperfections in the road or oncoming cars and that kind of thing.
Excellent. Well, you've referenced lumens there, so let's kind of start with some of the basics. And Ash, I'm going to test you and put you on the spot here. What is a lumen?
In short, a lumen is a unit of measurement that measures the amount of light that a light source can produce. So if you imagine one LED, the amount of light that that LED produces, that diode produces, is your lumen rate. So you'll see brands usually, and it's the most common measurement, I think, they'll quote how many lumens that the LED or LEDs will produce from their front light.
Very impressive. You've done your homework for this podcast. Jack referenced there the fact that we typically kind of recommend starting at around 400 lumens if you want to see with a light. But certainly if you are a regular rider on unlit roads or unlit lanes, then 600 lumens to 1,000 is definitely the place to be. So Ash, when you're kind of out doing your night riding and you're perhaps venturing out into the lanes where there aren't streetlights to help with seeing the way ahead of you, what do you kind of look for?
The road ahead of me, but that's not the question you asked. I think when I'm looking for a light to see when I haven't got any street lamps around me, I'm looking for a wide beam. What you can get with a lot of brighter lights, so higher lumens, etc., you will find that the beam will flood a lot better because it's got a lot of a lot of light in which to be able to do that. I'm looking for a good focused beam as well at the furthest point. So if I want to be able to ride a lot faster or keep my speed up, that I would normally ride at about summer sort of speeds, then I'll need something that can actually focus a beam further up the road, so I've got time to react to whatever's coming along as well. Generally speaking, on the road, those are my two key things that I'm looking for: a strong focused beam and something that diffuses the light very well as well.
I mean, that idea of choosing a light that's bright enough to match your riding speed. I mean, Jack, can you talk a bit more about that? Because riding at night is very different in terms of your perception of speed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, riding at lower speeds feels faster off-road. Your eyes are less focused on what's going on around you, and you are just in this little beam of light. So you don't necessarily need an absolute lumen bazooka on the front of your bike to blind oncoming drivers. But if you are riding at higher speeds, going up in terms of overall power is definitely something worth considering. And it's not uncommon for road lights to see up to about 1,000 lumens. And as a fun little extra, just because we were on the subject of power, you will sometimes also see lights referred to as their lux power. And that's more general, generally speaking, on dynamo lights, which we'll come on to. But lux is a measure of how much light falls on a surface compared to how much is outputted. So, how much light actually reaches its intended destination. And about 100 lux is what you'll see on the best sort of road going lights there. And there's not an easy conversion between the two, between lumens and lux, but it is another measure of power overall.
But a good way to sort of conceptualize it in your mind is if you've got a thousand lumen light that puts out 1,000 lumens, if the beam is not very well focused, the lux that falls upon a surface won't be as concentrated or
exactly.
as high.
Exactly. Yeah.
Jack, you mentioned a lumen bazooka there. And I think, if anyone who listened to our mountain bike lights buyer's guide, I think Alex referenced an 8,000 lumen light, which basically turns night into day if you're out on the trail. But you certainly do not need that if you are purely a road rider or even just doing some kind of light off-road riding on bridleways or perhaps an unlit cycle path. So to kind of tidy up the lumen section, if you're riding in the city, looking at around 400 lumens or less is fine because you are looking for a light for which other road users can see you. But if you're heading onto unlit lanes and unlit roads, then around 600 to 1,000 lumens will generally be fine. And the higher your speed and the more serious rider you are, the higher lumen count we'd probably recommend. Ash, you alluded to some of the other features to look for in a light beam pattern being one of them, but also battery life is a key point, and the battery itself, the modes, the mounting system, charging, and we'll also talk briefly about rear lights as well, because if you have a front light, then you certainly need a rear one. But to start with batteries and battery life, Jack, talk to me about how road lights are set up, because in the mountain bike world, quite often the battery is external to the light, but that's not often the case when you're using a light designed specifically for the road.
Absolutely, yes, particularly on lights to be seen with, it's the case that they are always a all-in-one kit, essentially. So the battery is integrated into the light. Normally they're quite long and thin in terms of layout. But yeah, on road lights, they're generally an all-in-one unit. On some slightly more higher powered lights, you will get a separate battery, but usually it's an all-in-one unit.
Why would someone choose a light with an external battery? Can we rule that out for road use cases?
No, not necessarily. I think the external battery just means you can have a larger battery without the light itself, the whole unit becoming excessively bulky. And on a road bike in particular, where you're going to have less space around the clamping area, they become quite disruptive and might interrupt your ability to use the tops. On a mountain bike, that's not an issue because you've got like 800 millimeters of real estate to play with. But normally you will see the batteries mounted elsewhere on the bike. But for road lights, it tends to be one, sometimes quite bulky, all-in-one unit, and it takes up slightly less space on the bars.
I think the idea of kind of considering your kind of cockpit layout and how much space you have on the bars is quite important, because there's some quite clever mounting systems out there these days that help keep things as clean and tidy as possible, which we'll come on to. Ash, to go to you, runtimes are also clearly key when we're talking about batteries and battery life. So clearly the more powerful a light is, the shorter the runtime will be on that most powerful setting. So what do you need to consider when balancing power output, battery life, and claimed runtimes from manufacturers?
Well, you should always take claimed runtimes with a pinch of salt. Every time we review a light, we will obviously test the actual runtime such as it is. We'll certainly do that in the most powerful setting, as well as possibly a lower powered setting as well, to give some context to that. Considering what you need and how long you need to ride with that light for over one ride is probably the most important thing you need to consider. And it could be that you may decide you only need 600 lumens of output, but you need to ride with that light for 4 hours. But in order to achieve that, you need a unit that's a lot bigger, that potentially has a mode that could do 1,000 lumens on it, but you don't necessarily need to use that mode. But what you're buying there is the battery power and the capacity in that battery to give you that runtime you need at the power that you need it.
That's a really good point. Often, as you say, the maximum output of your light isn't necessarily the mode that you're going to use most often, but it will allow you to achieve a usable runtime at a lower output.
I think I'd just agree with that. Being realistic with how you want to ride in the winter is probably best advised. Yes, you know, when I ride with battery lights, I don't go out usually for more than an hour or two in the evening. And if I can get a decent power out of that for an hour or two, okay, sure, maybe another light could do 10 hours at that power, but I'm not going to go do a 10-hour Audax in the middle of winter at night. So it's not a problem. So as always with buying decisions, consider what is most realistic for your riding goals.
I mean, let's imagine you are going to go out and do a 10-hour winter Audax, and you need, say it's an overnight Audax. Let's really kind of put the challenge down. How do you know you've got enough battery life to last you through that Audax? Are there any features that you should look out for on some specific lights to kind of ensure you've got enough illumination to see you through to sunrise?
The very best lights, I used a Blackburn Dayblazer, I think it was called. And that was a very intelligent light, which included an LCD display with an actual percentage remaining, showing you how much battery life you've got. Like, that is the kind of the golden standard. Some lights, a lot of exposures, for example, will include an app so you can connect it to your phone. Might seem a little bit gimmicky, but like, if you want to get an actual accurate reading of what you've got left and estimated runtime, fantastic. And then the cheaper lights will typically have an illuminated switch more often than not that will flash different colors to give you an estimation of how much battery life you have left. But my first port of call would be reading Bike Radar's fantastic independent reviews to find out exactly which light will last long enough.
Shameless plug, but a very important one. We do have dozens of light reviews. And as I said at the top of the podcast, we've summarized the best bike lights we've tested in our buyer's guide, and we will put a link to that in the description. Ash, let's move on to beam pattern. You mentioned this earlier and the idea of wanting a focused beam pattern, which is quite different often to what a mountain biker or off-road rider might want, where they want a flood of light that's going to illuminate both the trail and some of the context and forest around them. So, you know, why is it important to have a focused beam if you're riding predominantly on the road?
Well, having a focused beam will mean that the light can travel further. Because as light travels through the air, it loses its potency. So when it lands on, you know, something that's a surface that's further away, you won't get as much light landing on that. The lux rating that we talked about earlier, you won't have as much light there. So you need that high power at the light, and you need it focused well enough so that it can shine the light where you want it to be as you're riding through, you know, the winter trails, not trails, through the winter road, you know.
Is it also important to have some light in the periphery to kind of provide that context as to what's going on around you?
I personally think it is. I don't think it's a hard and fast rule as to whether you actually need that or not, depending on the riding you're doing. I prefer to have it. I don't necessarily need the furthest beam. I'm happier riding at a slightly slower pace, so I don't need as much time to react to what's coming right in front of me, but I like to see what's coming beside me, because there's lots of animals, squirrels, rabbits, and so on out there at the moment that you know, have it in for me. I want to be able to see them coming. Plus, it's also important as well for seeing edges of junctions and so on when you're turning into one, for example, and for peripheral vision as well. If there's more light coming out and landing around you, being diffused outwards, then something that's said maybe, you know, a car or a person standing at that angle is going to be able to see you a little bit easier than something that doesn't diffuse a light that far.
Absolutely. And I know Wiltshire, the lanes of Wiltshire are renowned for their nocturnal wildlife at this time of year. So God knows what's out there trying to hunt you down.
Yeah.
You know, the beam pattern is very important, but also what you do with that beam pattern is absolutely key. So, I mean, Jack, let's talk a little bit about etiquette. What should you do with your beam and where should you point it?
Not into other people's eyes. That's the key thing. I mean, from a pure safety perspective, it's obviously a foolish idea to be pointing a giant bright light into the eyes of a driver, because as it would be if you were driving a car, they can't see you. It's going to be very distracting and hard to, more than anything, judge depth and how far away you are from them. And if they're dazzled, they won't be able to see you. If you're on a shared use path, it's also a good idea to either cover the top of your light, or if you feel comfortable doing so, very slightly kind of cover it itself so you're not blinding oncoming users. But really, just use your common sense. Don't point it up straight into the eyes of oncoming drivers and keep it pointed a little bit down. And really just ask yourself, like, do you need to see what the tree canopy above you looks like? Probably not if you're riding, unless you are out specifically spotting owls.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think many lights will offer some movement either on the light bracket itself between the unit and the mount, or between the mount and the handlebar. There's a Lazine light that I'm using at the moment where you can quite quickly and easily just kind of rotate the beam downwards if you need to, if you've got a car approaching or another rider approaching on an unlit lane. I think we've all, or anyone who's a motorist certainly, or been in a car, will have been in a situation where a car's approached you with its light still on full beam, and it's, you know, it's not a good situation to be in. So also a key point to remember if you're out on the bike. Related to that, there are also STVZO lights. So, Ash, this is a light designation that came out of Germany but is kind of gaining prominence elsewhere. So let's start with a description of what an STVZO light is.
Without getting into the minutiae of the detail, the STVZO is essentially a set of regulations that dictate the beam shape and the brightness of that beam as it applies onto the road. So lux is really important here, because it's how that, as Jack mentioned earlier, it's how that beam interacts with the road and what you can see on the road. So what you'll find is that it will cut off elements of the beam that might get into the eyes of traffic coming towards you or to the periphery as well a little bit. We're talking about front lights here, but it also applies to rear lights as well, where I believe flashing patterns are banned as well. So you can only use static patterns. So you can't have a flashing front light as well with STVZO regulations.
And those regulations, in terms of the law, apply specifically in Germany, but STVZO compliant lights are becoming more widely available elsewhere. We do have a test ongoing of some of these lights at the moment, so I'm sure you'll see them on Bike Radar in the coming months. But there are also some lights that incorporate perhaps some of the thinking behind STV Zeolites in a different format. So I know that one we're looking at the moment is the Trek Ion Pro Commuter, I think it's called. And, you know, that's not necessarily compliant to those regulations, but it does have a feature called Kine Beam, where there's effectively a high and a low beam mode. Is that right, Ash? I know you've been looking after this one.
Yes, yeah, essentially. So kind of the whole principle of it is it gives you the best of both worlds. Much like, you know, if you're traveling around in a car, everyone's got a high beam and a low beam. The low beam is automatically dimmed downwards to stop glaring into other driver's eyes on the other side of the road. In this country, the face is a particular direction, so the traffic on the other side of the carriageway isn't getting blinded by you. It's why you put your reflectors on the front of your car lights. Or at least in recent times, perhaps car lights are intelligent enough to be able to switch over themselves. But in recent times, you always had to put reflectors on to shield that beam. But the principle applies for bike lights as well. You have a high beam and a low beam, and it helps you stop glaring into people's eyes.
I'm going to keep this brief because it's definitely a pet subject of mine. I'm a big fan of STV Zeolites, but one of the reasons they've become more popular is that with that heavily shaped beam, you can generally opt for a lower powered light that will put the light where you want it for road riding. And as such, your run times will generally be greater. I'm personally a big proponent of them for just general riding outside of the legal reasons, because I think they're very, very good. And we do have a full buyer's guide for STV Zeolites alongside that test on site.
We do. And Ash, you mentioned the fact that lights on cars are becoming smarter. But, you know, another light that we're looking at the moment is the Exposure Strada Active, I think it's called. Active,
right.
With a K.
Yep.
And that's very similar in how it works.
Yeah, it's got a sensor on the front that essentially senses other light sources in front of you, and it dips your beam. Again, cars tend to come with this these days, but it's nice to see that kind of innovation coming to cycling, even if it means you don't have to take your hands off the bars and to change the mode, for example. Some lights have a remote as an accessory, but if it doesn't, then you don't have to faff around with it. It will just happen.
I've actually ridden behind Felix Smith, our video manager. He has the rear light version of the Exposure Active, and I can confirm it is very, very good. It actually works very, very well. It turns off from a flashing mode to a steady mode when it detects a light right behind you, which is great if you're riding in a group. It's really good.
That is good to know. We also have both of these lights, the Trek light and the Exposure light, out for test at the moment. So we will deliver our full verdict and actually how useful and usable those features are in the coming weeks and months. Let's move on to the various modes that a light can offer. And, you know, typically this covers both the output, so from, you know, a low lumen output through to medium and high, but also steady and flash-in modes. And I'll come to you here, Jack, because you commissioned an excellent feature last year with some of the legalities around flashing and steady lights that Ash has touched upon, but also perhaps what's safest to use.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite an emotive subject, I dare say, and it's, you know, a subject of ire quite often from drivers. But the key facts are that flashing lights can be safer in terms of improving your visibility, provided they are used alongside a steady beam. The reason being is that research generally shows that flashing lights make depth perception, particularly in busy environments, very, very difficult to judge from a driver or rider's perspective. It's kind of pairing the two of them together will give you the best chance of, okay, this is a flashing light. The lizard side of my human brain is spotting a flashing light, but with the steady light keeping you actually visible in between those flashes. The legalities of it depend on country to country, but here in the UK, essentially, provided it meets a minimum lumen requirement, which all modern lights do, and as long as it flashes no faster than 4 hertz, which is 4 times per second, then you're pretty much fine. However, I would say that from an etiquette perspective, keeping that flashing a little lower than 4 hertz would be well advised. It's just very unpleasant being behind a very, very fast flashing light. But if you want to increase your chances of being visible, pairing that flashing light with a steady one is your best bet. And as a final point, it doesn't relate specifically to lights, but improving your visibility at night, the best chances you can do is fitting either a steady light or reflectors to your heels when you're riding or your pedals. That kind of weird up and down movement is very, very noticeably a cyclist from a driver's perspective. Nobody else kind of mimics that movement on the road.
I'd also say as well that I've got a Lazine Strip Drive Pro currently on test at the moment, so you'll see a review of that pretty shortly. That has a very, very bright 300 lumen output. It's incredibly, incredibly bright. But what it also can do is blend a flashing mode with a static mode as well within the one unit. So it's worth looking for that as well. If you want, you know, not all brands are great at being able to describe what the modes do. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at, say, their brand page or whatever, their product page. So when I come to review that, I'll be sure to let you know if it's a good one. But we should be doing that across all lights anyway, shouldn't we?
Mm-hmm. That's a good point, Ash. I think that's a rear light that you have there, but also both on front and rear lights, there's often a pulsing mode, which is kind of that idea of it remains steady whilst adding a flash on top, which I think is certainly useful when I've used it. Ash, to kind of talk a little bit about your kind of preferred setup, Jack alluded to the idea of running two lights at the front, two lights at the rear potentially at any one time. Is that something you like to do, or do you kind of just stick with the one?
I like to stick with the one. Clean lines on my bike are very
style over safety.
Exactly. No, I think having the right light means that you don't necessarily need to have two. That's my opinion on it. Although having two, there is definitely a utility for having two for sure. So I like to run, just one front, one rear centrally on the bike. I like to mount mine beneath my Garmin mount on my bike as well, so it doesn't clutter up the bar stem setup. Looks really, really nice on my bike, actually. I'm really pleased with how it all integrates. So that's how I like to run mine anyway, and I'm quite happy just to strap a light onto the seat post, or occasionally I have another light that sometimes I use, which has a little clip on it, like you would have, like a belt clip, and that just goes onto the back of my Topic saddlebag, no problem at all. It's not a Topic light actually, but it's a light that does attach in that way, and it's super useful as well. If you don't happen to have the seat post space, for example, I don't necessarily recommend mounting them onto your seat stays. Yeah. I don't recommend that on the basis that it kind of shines the light upwards because of the natural angle of the stay itself. That being said, you can, I believe, get a light or two out there on the market that does compensate for that, and they're designed specifically to be put on in that location, but they're very few and far between. As a general rule, just assume it doesn't.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
They used to say, go west. What they meant was go forward. Find your own way. Make something out of nothing. It can be tempting to take it easy, but discovery doesn't wait. So this summer, see what it means to make the most of dawn, dusk, and every minute in between. The truth lies west. Discover yours at travelwyoming.com.
I think there's no right or wrong to this, and it kind of depends on what I've got charged up at the time, but I tend to stick with Jack's kind of school of thought. Certainly at the front, I like to run kind of a little blinking light, often kind of a nog one, which are very good just to kind of try and attract attention. And then the more kind of high-powered light, have that on the constant beam partly so I can see where I'm going. So we've covered modes and what you can expect from modes and steady versus pulsing and flashing. But also I think it's important to consider, if you are a serious night rider, how you get between those various modes. Jack, do you have any experience here of what a good setup is, or what a good light offers in terms of being able to find a usable mode quickly for the type of ride you're doing?
Yeah, there's a lot of variation between how well brands do this. The majority of lights, you scroll through modes based on the button. I'm very much generalizing here, but normally it'll be a long press of the button to turn it on, and then a single short press to scroll between modes. The worst lights don't remember the mode that you were on previously, which is incredibly annoying, especially if the first mode that comes on is a disaster. You know, it's some horrible, really gnarly one that's going to blind drivers around you. But the best lights will remember the previous mode you're on, and hopefully you can just do a very quick click to scroll between them all. Some lights will have slightly more advanced controls. That Blackburn light I referred to had sort of left and right buttons to flick between the two. But the kind of way I described there with the individual clicks is more common.
I think as well, some lights where you pay more, you do get a more kind of complex or advanced programming opportunity to program the modes as you need them. And, you know, I think if you are a serious night rider, that's something to consider. You know, it can be annoying and borderline dangerous sometimes if you're out in a lane and you want to switch from one mode to the next, but the sequence that the light is set up to a standard takes you from the most powerful output to a flashing beam, and all of a sudden you can't see where you're going. So having some functionality whereby you can customize the light and customize the modes is very useful, but not necessarily essential if you're just kind of dabbling with night riding.
And to that point as well, I mean, you can get apps as well on your phone, which may, as Jack sort of mentioned earlier, they may sound gimmicky. They may sound like they're making a deal out of nothing. But actually, I've tested lights in the past where it links up to your phone. You can then customize the modes that you need. So if you've got a light which has got 8 or 9 modes, which generally speaking is totally unnecessary, to be honest, you know, you could shut that down to, say, having 2 or 3 modes that you will use: a flashing mode, a combined mode, or a static mode. Job done.
I'd say of apps and integration in general, like 10 years ago, 5 years ago, I would have very much scoffed at this sort of stuff. But I think we're, as a society, we're used to tech and integrations with apps more generally. And as such, like the products, the apps have got better. So it's not something to discredit absolutely from the offset. Apps and integrations with lights, it's not the worst thing in the world. Same also with kind of integration, if you're lucky enough to ride with an electronic group set, having the ability to scroll between modes from, for example, the buttons on the top of DI2 is pretty cool in a Tron-like way, but also actually genuinely really useful.
Well, firstly, it sounds like I need to get myself one of these lights with app integration, because I can't imagine that being very useful. But actually, can you describe that, the idea of linking your DI2 group set with a light as well, and also how you can, in some examples, link your computer to the battery life on your lights?
Yes, I know that Garmin and Bontrager certainly offer that. I'd struggle to say off the top of my head who else offers integration with DI2. But essentially, in DI2 shifters on the road, you have 2 auxiliary buttons built into the hoods of the lights, into the hoods of the shifters, rather. And clicking one or other of those will allow you to shift between modes on the lights wirelessly. Very cool. And like genuinely quite functional, because it means you don't have to take your hands off of the brake levers to change between modes. And it's just a really nice, neat integration. Some lights will offer remotes to essentially do the same functionality, but integration's cool.
I've used those DIT buttons on the top of hoods once to change gear, and you feel a bit like a fighter pilot using them. To wrap up this section on modes, let's talk briefly about daytime modes, daytime running lights. Ash, that Lazine Strip Drive Pro light that you mentioned with the 300 lumen output, which is very high for a rear light. I imagine Lazine would describe that most powerful mode, the 300 lumen mode, as suitable for daytime use, because the more power you have, the more likely it is to attract a driver's attention when the sun is out, or you know, when at least there is some ambient light, even if it is a gloomy or wet day.
Yeah, essentially that. So, I mean, they would describe that. It will cut through the ambient light that you've got, whether it's a dim sort of day or a bright summer's day. Actually, having those lights on your bike is a sensible thing to have year round these days. I don't always carry them when it's bright sunshine. You know, during the summer, if I'm wearing colourful kit or I've got a colourful bike or whatever, I like to think I'm pretty well seen. That's a personal thing. But I totally understand it when I'm out with a club ride, for example. I've got friends who are just running a daytime running light on their bike, for example. Absolutely, go ahead, because if it helps you be seen in any situation, then go for it.
I would say on this point, it's not actually the law to ride with a light during the day. But if you are interested in learning more about the law and lights in the UK, all you really need to know is that you have to use them between sunset and sunrise, quite specifically. Using them during the day is very much a choice. But if you would like to learn more about lights and the law, head to the link in the video description, in the podcast description, because we do have a full guide there.
And Jack, I know daytime running lights, that's another emotive subject. What's your take? Do you use a light in the day, particularly in winter?
I, in winter, tend to ride a bike with dynamo lights, so I have lights on all the time, regardless. But no, I do usually, unless I am riding in a group, as Ash says, where it might be a bit antisocial and you would hope that we're visible as a big group, I do personally tend to run them. I would normally go for a steady light on the front and a flashing light on the rear. I don't know. I think my perceptions have changed over time, where again, maybe like 10 years ago, I just didn't really think about it. But as it's become more normalised and perhaps marketed a bit more, it is something I'm more conscious of, being visible through lights as well as how I choose to dress.
I'd also point out as well that sometimes you can, there's an argument to say you could go slightly too powerful. So although I will spoil no conclusions in my review of the Lezyne light, 300 lumens is an awful lot for a red light on the back of your bike. So there's a school of thought and an argument to say that actually that's quite distracting because it's so bright, and you can't control which direction it's kind of, you can mount it in a certain way, but you can't control exactly if it's impacting on someone's eyes and so on. There's an argument to say it could be slightly distracting as well as drawing attention to you. You can go over that optimum sort of attraction level, if you see what I mean, you know, notice me level. But you can see what I think about that in my review.
Well, look out for that one. I think just to kind of recap on that and to jump back to lumens at the start, when we talked about the idea of having between 600 and 1,000 lumens, that was, of course, referring to a front light. You know, generally speaking, what, 100 lumens upwards or around 100 lumens is absolutely fine for a rear light?
I think so. 100 to 150 is your gold standard look at me sort of light. Any more than that is not necessary, but as I say, you could choose to have it because, you know, it's a peace of mind thing as well. You ride more confidently and I won't say properly, but you ride more confidently if you know you've got a better chance of being seen from behind you. You know, you don't flinch when a car comes up near you, for example, because you know there's a better chance that you've been seen. At least that's the experience I have.
Excellent. Well, let's move on to mounting systems now, because, you know, hopefully in most examples, you know, you're kind of looking for a fit and forget mount, but there are different systems out there and they're not all as easy to use as they could be. So Jack, talk to me about your experience with using the various different type of mounts and what you look for when you're setting up your lights.
Sure. So lights tend to be mounted in one or two ways. A design that's designed to be taken off easily and removed easily, and ones which are a bit more fixed. The likes of commuter lights will tend to be designed to just be taken off every day, taken up to your office and charged. And that's reflected in the fact they have a lower battery life. Other lights might have a more secure system, which use hinged clamps, for example, or as Ash alluded to, slightly more integrated options that fit into Garmin mounts, for example, or out front mounts. They will be a bit more secure and less wobbly as a result. For commuting lights day to day, I think having a removable mount is a very good thing, but having the light be able to remove from that mount is also worth considering. Ladder locks, which see normally a silicon band with sort of ladder shape fitted to go around a hook, are very, very good and very easy to remove. However, over time, I don't think I've ever had one which hasn't broken after a couple seasons of use. So being able to remove the light from that so it doesn't get stolen when you leave it locked up is definitely a good thing to look for. But equally, you don't want to be having your lights completely fixed and bolted on if it is for a commuter light bike, because then it'll be a pain to remove them every time.
Yeah, don't do what I do, where I fixed mine via a GoPro adapter mount, and now I can't move it. And to recharge it, it needs to have a cable that runs into the back of it. And so I've needed to buy a really long micro USB cable in order to plug it in using the plug I have available at home. So I created a problem for myself and I've gotten over it now, but it's not the easiest thing in the world. If you do need to take it off, charge it at work and so on, you'd have to get your Allen key out and unscrew the bolt and then drop it out. And they're not always the easiest things to fit either, because the tolerances are always quite tight. That being said, it fits super solidly and it isn't going to come off at any time because it's threaded right in there. So
it is something we pay very close attention to in our reviews, because not all light mounts are made equally. And, you know, we will score a light down for a poorly designed mount. There are fewer of them these days, but they're not all perfect.
Yeah. Jack, I know you had quite a cool setup on your bike a couple of years ago. You've since moved to a dynamo, but you kind of integrated the out front mount, as Ash alluded to earlier, with the light, which kept the handlebar nice and clean and also just puts the light in quite a sensible position. So what are the various options out there for someone looking to go down that route?
So I had a K-Edge out front mount, much like Ash, with a GoPro underside. Well, basically, it's like a three-prong mount designed to mount a GoPro. Cat Eye, I have quite a few Cat Eye lights. To their credit, they make a really good range of additional mounts for, you know, wherever you want. They do fork mounts. They do the GoPro adapter mount, as I'm using, and also things like helmet straps. In this case, I got the GoPro adapter that slides really nicely into the Cat Eye light, and then that fits to the underside of the K-Edge mount. A little bit of a bodge, if you like, but a very, very, very neat bodge. Some brands, such as Bontrager as well, will kind of create lights or rather mounts to go alongside the lights, which integrate with their stems. That's a really, really nice solution and keeps the front end of the bike really, really clean. But more critically, I dare say, very, very secure. A wobbling light is really annoying. In fact, Felix Smith, to besmirch his good name, I was behind him a couple of weeks ago on a ride, and he had a light which remained unnamed with a very wobbly, wobbly mount. And it was so distracting riding behind him, where I thought he had it on a very high, like strobe mode. Very unpleasant. And the sort of thing you should not be looking for in a light.
I think he was probably just trying to encourage you to take a turn on the front.
Quite possibly.
The Bontrager system you mentioned, I think it's Blender with no
Blender,
E.
Blender, yeah, that's it.
For some reason. Is their kind of system for kind of integration around kind of computers and lights. And it is a very smart system. There's lots of options if you check out the Trek website. And generally, I've had very positive experiences with Bontrager lights, and it's good to see brands kind of taking the mountain side of things seriously as well, because it can make a real difference to your overall bike setup.
I think I'm going to have to revisit our guide on brands that are constantly named wrong, because I go for Bontrager, but I think you're right, it's Bontrager. I think you're correct.
I think we've done a video on that, didn't we?
We did. You should check it out.
One of us is right, at least. Well, maybe we're not. Maybe there's a third option. Okay, let's talk charging. I think the first point to kind of emphasize here is to remember to charge your lights, and I think that's a reminder for me more than anyone. But also, certainly over the past year, and particularly this season, we've seen lights move from micro USB to the new-ish USB-C standard. Ash, I know you're testing a few lights at the moment, so is that generally what you're seeing?
It's really mixed, to be honest. I've personally never had a problem with micro USB. I've never had it go wrong.
Have you ever plugged the light in correct the first time, though? Or have you put it in upside down every single time?
I concede I've done that so many times I can't count. But it works just fine, and there's not a problem with it. The thing about USB-C is it's not the fact that it will charge fast, although that is a handy positive. The main thing is that it's just a more secure and solid protocol to plug into the back of your light, and it will go in either each way, upside down or the other way, and it clicks in easily and will charge your light just as well as anything else.
USB-C was designed as a standard. I might be slightly mixing things up here, but as a standard for charging as well as data transfer. Yes. Micro USB, on the other hand, was originally designed as a standard for like cameras to get data off. So as a sort of like in and out all the time charging thing, that's not what it was initially designed for. And I think that's why it's not quite so good. And it's directional, which is really annoying.
Yeah. It's also worth pointing out as well, just because you've got a USB-C cable end that goes into the light to charge it, at the other end of that cable, you can have whatever you like. You can have USB-A. You could have just a plug. Yeah. You could have anything on the end of that. And you would still get the power in. If it's USB-C, it can be two-way directional, so you could draw power in some lights from the light and charge something else, like your phone, if it happens to have a USB-C connection on it. That's doable in some lights, but it's really an added extra, and you'd only really want to do that if you were using your light as a battery.
I think I suppose bike packing trips that's potentially a useful application. Yeah. In terms of being able to use your light to use it as a power bank to charge a computer or your phone or that kind of thing.
Yeah, computers, people do it often. I think on a phone, I'd probably want the redundancy of a separate battery pack.
Sure.
A paranoid young man. But I think as an auxiliary power source for your computer, like, yeah, great, why not? And also if your batteries do run out, they lose power over time. It's true of lights, it's true of computers. If you have a computer on its last legs and you don't want to replace it, it's quite a nice way to extend its life.
God forbid your phone running out of battery in the middle of nowhere and not being able to
Instagram
and share share the beautiful surroundings of your most recent rides. I think with the USB side of things, you know, most lights or most electrical applications are moving towards USB-C, but you know, ultimately, it's not really the kind of thing to base your buying decision around unless you're particularly passionate about these kind of things. But I would agree that USB-C is generally easier and better to use, you know, albeit a kind of fairly marginal gain over micro USB.
I'll point out as well that the cable I bought, the extra long cable I bought to fit to plug charge my front light, actually has three ends on it. So it's got a lightning connector, a micro USB-C, and a USB-C connector on the
front.
Sorted
for life.
So I'm sorted whatever I have coming in for testing.
There will be a new standard within years. Don't you worry about that.
USB-C-D.
Brilliant. Well, we've covered charging, mounting systems, modes, beam pattern, batteries, battery life, lumens. Is there anything else to add, Jack?
Well, you know, I couldn't talk about lights without talking about my favorite pet subject, dynamo lights, which is definitely a subject for another day. I will not make you endure that. Dynamo lights are a whole other category of lights, which are, in brief, powered by the motion of your bike, generally speaking, with a generator integrated into the front hub of your bike or via a separate accessory which runs on the rim or the tire. Dynamo lights have the advantage of having an infinite runtime. And, you know, generally, they tend to be quite high, well-made, nicely integrated with bikes and just a good solid system. And personally, what I'd recommend for any dedicated night rider. We have a full buyer's guide written by me, commissioned by you, George, on Bike Radar. And I urge you to read that or listen out for a future podcast where I will talk passionately and enthusiastically on the subject for quite some time.
I think let's commit to doing that. We'll have a podcast on dynamos in the nearish future, certainly over the winter, because you know, I've never used a dynamo, but you know the benefit is obvious. But I think it can be a tricky subject to get your head around in terms of the options out there and setup and so on. So I would be keen to learn more.
Well, that I'd be pleased to do it. It is a subject which benefits from knowledge, which sounds quite arrogant, but as an overall category, it's not as well sort of standardized in terms of how information is shared compared to battery lights. So I hope I can digest that into a thrilling 40-minute podcast about dynamos, which I promise you I will do.
Brilliant. Well, listen out for that one. And Ash, anything else to add from you on the subject of lights?
The only thing that occurs to me really are radar systems. Ooh. And radar lights that you can have. Now, usually they respond a bit like parking sensors in a car, I suppose. They sort of respond to obstacles and things that are approaching you from behind. Garmin has its Varia system, which is pretty well publicized. We've seen a few of their previous editions of their lights. We've got the latest one in at the moment for testing. And yeah, essentially the light should or could change modes and, you know, brighten up or do a more sort of staccato style flashing mode if someone is approaching at speed, for example. And you can also get ones that can sense when you're sort of slowing down as well. The little accelerometer inside that can sense when you're slowing down and will flash when you are pulling the brakes as well. It's quite clever, to be honest. But yeah, there are sort of other themes of rear lights that you can get that change their modes depending on the surroundings as well, aside from having a light sensor on them.
Without getting too lost in the weeds, have you either of you used a radar light and what did you think of it?
I have. George?
I haven't, so I can answer that one very quickly and pass back to you, Ash.
Oh, fair enough. Yes, I have. I can't tell what's going on behind me, you know, because I'm not always looking behind me. Yes. When I'm riding, but I'm always looking forwards. At where I'm going. But you know, usually these lights have a, you know, that they have a radar sensor that talks to. So in this system, in this series of events, I was using a Garmin system. It integrated very well with my Garmin head unit, and you can see on there where, you know, it gives you sort of an estimation as to where the car is behind you, so it gives you a little bit more awareness. Did I end up relying upon it? No, I didn't. I prefer to use my ears. I certainly wouldn't ever ride my bike with earphones in and blocking out that really important sensory experience as you're riding along. It's super important to be able to hear what's coming behind you.
Another emotive subject for another day.
Yeah. I feel very strongly about that one. So you can have me on a podcast for that one day as well. But yeah, essentially, you know, it doesn't change the way I ride, but it does give me something to sort of sort of look at and to be aware of in front of me. My Garmin's screen will change color from green to yellow to red to tell me that something's approaching. It will give me a little dot marker to tell me that something's coming. It can do it with multiple things as well. So if I've got three cars behind me, it will usually spot those. It usually doesn't mistake other riders for cars, which is helpful.
You're always going too quick to get passed by other riders, aren't you?
That's not true. Absolutely not true. But yes, it's a very useful system, and I think peace of mind for someone who wants it.
Jack, I know you've had generally positive experiences before using it's the Garmin radar you've used.
Correct, yeah. I used the Varia. I only ask as I know that when we reviewed the original system, the reviewer didn't really like it. He thought it was quite distracting and not very helpful. Personally, I had mixed experiences where in an urban setting, it was useless. Like I know there's a bus behind me because I can hear it revving, and I had a really annoying quirk where you couldn't pause it. However, on very quiet back roads, I was pretty blown away by it. Like, it was very, very helpful, and would often see cars long before I did. And I found the extra awareness only a net positive. I will say, though, I haven't really used it in a very long time, which maybe speaks to how necessary I think it is. But as a bit of tech, something I think is very cool, and I think a lot of riders who are maybe less used to being aware on the road or looking over your shoulder, whatever, I think not a bad thing to have.
It's worth saying historically as well that the actual light itself, if you strip out the radar and the extra money you would pay for that for the radar system, the light itself is a decent light.
Yes.
And is bright enough and does everything that you could want it to do. So having that little extra feature it's a fundamental feature at the end of the day, but if having that gives you that extra confidence to ride your bike wherever it is you're riding it, then it's no bad thing at the end of the day, I think.
Well, Garmin was the first brand to certainly kind of popularise the idea of having a radar system integrated into a rear light. But I think Brighton also launched one this summer, and I'm fairly sure there's another new one, but I can't remember which brand
Magic
it was.
Shine. It's a Magic Shine.
Magic Shine. So there you go. It is a limited but growing category. So, you know, certainly have a look out for those radar lights if you think they'd be useful for you. Well, chaps, let's leave it there. Hopefully this has been an illuminating discussion.
Oh, George, I can see how smug you are with that.
And you've dazzled our listeners with your infinite knowledge on bike lights. But I think that's a good place to bring it to a close.
I'm speechless, George.
It's absolutely astonishing. Good work.
Well, if you want more witty puns, then make sure you subscribe to the Bike Radar podcast through your podcast provider of choice. And please do leave us a rating and review. We always value your feedback and your generous ratings. It really helps us bump us up the podcast charts and get this out to other bike riders like yourself. If you have a question for us, either on the topic of bike lights or a suggestion for a new podcast, then do email us at podcast@bikeradar.com. Again, we always love hearing from you and we'll be sure to get back to you. We'll leave it there. Thank you much for listening, and we will speak to you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you've not done so already, please subscribe and share with your friends, or leave us a rating if you've enjoyed this episode.